You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Very little has been made public about the murky world of offshore tax havens and the people and companies who use them. But the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists has obtained 2.5 million records relating to more than 120,000 companies and trusts in more than 10 offshore jurisdictions. And the documents reveal a complex world where billions of dollars that belong to people as varied as hedge fund managers, doctors, celebrities, and drug dealers have been stashed away in relative secrecy. The ICIJ has shared the records with a number of international news partners, including The Washington Post. And we are joined now by The Post's Scott Higham, who wrote, along with Michael Hudson and Marina Walker Guevara, a report called Offshore Havens Concealed Dangers. We have a link to that article and other investigations done by ICIJ partners on our show page at WNYC.org. Scott, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
Half of all global trade passes through offshore tax havens, and an estimated one-third of the world's wealth resides there. Just how much money are we talking about?
Well, that's a really good question, Leonard. I mean, nobody really knows for sure because these records are secret. The bank records are secret. The records documenting these trusts and offshore shell companies are secret. So this is an opportunity for the public to get a rare look inside of this offshore world. The estimates range anywhere from $8 billion to $32 billion. That's just in private global wealth. There could be much, much more in corporate global wealth. But the bottom line is nobody really knows. Billions and billions of dollars.
In the past, it was Swiss banks, but they are no longer a secret. So we have all these other places. How many offshore financial havens exist today?
You know, there's about 50 to 60 of them around the globe. Many of them are close to the United States and the Caribbean. The Cayman Islands are famous. The British Virgin Islands, St. Kitts, there's a lot of other places down in the Caribbean. And a lot of places in South America are starting to become very popular, particularly among American investors. Panama is one of the places. Uruguay is another place in South America that's becoming very, very popular with Americans seeking to hide their assets or to minimize their tax liability or to keep money away from creditors or people who might sue them. And a lot of Americans are starting to renounce their citizenship and move to these places. And on the other side of the globe, the South Pacific has become a very big place for offshore investors, specifically the Cook Islands, which is where the vast majority of these records come from.
Now, offshore, because they're all islands. You mentioned a couple of South American countries. Would we also include the situation in Cyprus or Liechtenstein, which seems to be the next in line to have some problems?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, offshore is kind of a euphemism. A lot of these places are not offshore at all. They're firmly ensconced in countries across the globe. And in fact, the United States is considered to be one of the great offshore havens for foreigners seeking to hide their assets. There are places in the United States where it's very, very difficult for foreign governments to figure out what's happening when somebody sets up a corporation, for instance, in Delaware or Nevada, Wyoming. There are certain places where the secrecy laws regarding corporations in America are just as stringent, in some cases more stringent than places like Cyprus and Liechtenstein. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Cyprus has brought this back into the news. It was in the news during the presidential campaign because of Mitt Romney's holdings in the Cayman Islands, which have never become fully public, and nobody really knows exactly what are in those accounts. But, you know, this is an ongoing debate in countries all over the globe.
And in the presidential campaign, the whole matter of the use of them as tax havens has become a big issue. You say we don't know how much money is in these things, personal $8 to $32 billion. That's a big range. So we have no idea how much these tax havens are costing the U.S. government in lost tax revenue.
We have no idea. The estimates are, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. But again, nobody really knows for sure. The people who are trying to clamp down on tax havens think it's several hundred million dollars a year that's lost to the Treasury, which, you know, in this time of sequestration and budget cuts is something that people up on Capitol Hill are screaming about and saying that, you know, we need to clamp down on our tax revenue going overseas. People who are in favor of these things think that's a vastly overestimated number and believe that it's far less than that. But nobody really knows for sure because it's very difficult to follow this money, and that's kind of the whole point of the offshore world.
Defenders of these havens often say that they grease the wheels of international trade. Is that true, and in what way?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, there are legitimate purposes for going offshore. One of them is, say, you're a corporation that's headquartered in New York City, and you have a business partner with a corporation that's headquartered in Singapore. You want to do an international deal. He doesn't want to put his money in the U.S. You don't want to put your money in Singapore, so you choose a neutral place, say the Caribbean, to hold the money that's going to be invested in this joint venture. So there are legitimate purposes for it. But you know, the people who argue in favor of the havens are kind of strict anti-regulation type folks who believe that the government should not get involved in commerce of any kind, whether it's domestic commerce or international commerce, and that the free enterprise and free market system should take care of its own. That governments don't need to step into this. That this is capitalism at its finest, and it should be allowed to proceed unfettered.
After reviewing these documents, have you been able to build a profile of what the average offshore investor might be like? How much they're worth? What industries they work in? Are there common threads?
Well, the common thread is you have to have money.
So I work in public radio, so that is unlikely.
That's right, and I work for the Washington Post. So the common thread, in addition to having enough money that would make it worthwhile, is that there are all different kinds of people that go to the offshore world. We saw lots of lawyers, lots of accountants, lots of doctors, plastic surgeons, regular surgeons, you know, people who have money who a lot of them are afraid that if they get sued, that they'll lose their nest egg, so they move it offshore where it's much more difficult for somebody who's pursuing a lawsuit to regain that. We also saw, you know, a lot of businessmen and women, corporations. What we saw that we thought was very interesting is that this world is used heavily by criminals who are perpetrating their fraudulent schemes. And they range from, you know, the famous like Bernie Madoff and Alan Stanford to people whose names you've never heard of. But nonetheless, they prey upon people in the offshore world because it's much harder for U.S. courts and prosecutors to prosecute them, to untangle the web of corporations that they've set up around the world. And so when people start to invest in some of these offshore havens, there are lots of people who are lurking in the shadows who take advantage of them.
Also, some of the other names that pop up, Rajaratnam, the billionaire hedge fund trader who was convicted of insider trading, and Paul Bilzerian, the famed corporate raider who was convicted of securities fraud. Is there, since these men use offshore accounts, is there any way the U.S. government or anyone else can get that money back? Can we get back any of the money that Bernie Madoff stashed away in an offshore account or Alan Stanford?
Well, you know, as we're seeing now, it takes years. It's much tougher on prosecutors and trustees who are in charge of these classes that are trying to recover money that's been stolen. It takes a long, long time. First, you have to find out where it went. That's one of the biggest problems is trying to discover exactly where the money was invested, exactly which bank accounts it's being held in. In some cases, they may never track down all the cash, but once you find out where the money is, then you've got to issue subpoenas through The Hague and international court and try to get various jurisdictions to obey those subpoenas for information, for bank records. So it's just an arduous process for prosecutors, trustees, and other people who are trying to recover money for investors.
I'm speaking with Scott Haim of The Washington Post, who wrote, along with Michael Hudson and Marina Walker-Guevara, a report called Offshore Havens, Concealed Dangers. As I said earlier, I work in public radio, so it's unlikely that I will ever do something like this. But let's say I had a large sum of money and that I wanted to hide. Can you take us through the steps that I would have to go through if I wanted to move it offshore?
Absolutely. It's fairly easy. If you just put in Google offshore lawyers, you'll come up with hundreds and hundreds of hits of law firms and accounting firms in the United States, many of them in New York, many of them in Miami, and many of them in Los Angeles, concentrated in those places principally, who do nothing but asset protection, estate planning, as they call it. It's kind of a euphemism for let's figure out a way to get your money out of this country, away from creditors, away from lawsuits, and away from the IRS.
And would they help me move the money offshore without doing background checks to see if I was an international arms dealer?
Well, you know, it depends. There's a lot of legitimate law firms that do this that would do their due diligence and make sure that you are who you say you are. There's a lot of other firms that are not as scrupulous. In fact, there was a study done. It was a collaboration by a couple of professors in the United States and one in Australia. And they did this kind of undercover investigation where they posed as terrorist arms traffickers, drug dealers, and they wrote emails to these firms all over the world and said, we want to open up an account, and will you help us? And they found, you know, time after time after time, that a lot of these firms did not ask any questions. They were more interested in obtaining their money.
Well, CTL, one of the companies that you looked at, was one of the companies you looked at. Co-founder Thomas Ward told the Post that the firm couldn't help but sometimes being duped by dishonest clients.
You know, the volume of people coming through, I mean, I think it's just almost impossible to do due diligence on everybody. You're getting thousands and thousands of people requesting to open up these offshore trusts, to open up these shell corporations, these limited liability partnerships. And you know, these are fairly small staffs. I mean, we ran a photograph of the headquarters of one of these facilities in the Washington Post over the weekend. And, you know, it is a very small, nondescript building that houses thousands upon thousands of these trusts and companies. And so it's just impossible, I think, with their limited staff to do the kind of due diligence that's required.
Well, one of the first steps is to either buy an existing company or create a secret one from scratch. How much would that cost me?
It doesn't cost much at all, Leonard. For about $500, $1,000.
Even though I'm going to stash millions of dollars away?
Absolutely. It doesn't cost much at all to set these things up. The companies that once you do set it up through the United States and then they reach out to one of these companies like CTL or some other company in the offshore world, those companies then take a percentage of the amount of money that you are going to be moving through these accounts. And then they'll connect you with a bank in Switzerland or Liechtenstein or Panama or any other place where the money will actually be held.
And then I have to find a director, a nominee director, are there people who do this for a living?
There are, and they basically will serve as the corporate director of your make-believe company. And I call it make-believe because it's just a shell, it's just a paper company.
I make up a name.
You make up a name, you know, XYZ company, and then they'll appoint somebody as the quote-unquote nominee director of the firm. And anybody who's looking at the paper will see this name of this nominee director. They will not see, you know, Leonard's name or Scott's name on the paperwork. So it's in terms of transparency, there's very little in it. And you can create numerous companies, the more that you create, the more layers that you create, the harder it is for somebody to unravel all this paper and get to the true owner of the company, which may be you or me.
I'm assuming that the directors are directors of many companies but have little control over the money that they're supposedly directing.
Yes, they have no control over the money. They have no control over the company. They have no say over what happens. They are on paper only, in name only. There was one couple in Nevis, which is another island in the Caribbean. They're from the UK. And, you know, they are responsible for setting up thousands and thousands and thousands of companies all across the world. And they are listed on all the paperwork as being the directors of the company. And they have nothing to do with them whatsoever.
Well, your story also brings up a nonprofit group with a very opaque Washington name, the Center for Freedom and Prosperity. What do they do?
Well, they're one of the kind of the free enterprise groups that argues that any interference by government in this world and in other matters of taxes is inappropriate, and we found in the massive leak of documents, numerous emails and other material that was circulating in the offshore world, where this one guy out of Singapore was trying to raise money through the Cook Islands and through other people who make millions and millions of dollars off of the offshore world to contribute to this Washington-based organization so that they could lobby Capitol Hill and the White House to make sure that no laws are being passed that would make it more difficult for American citizens to move their money offshore.
Now, Cook Islands are particularly protective of people who put their money there.
Yes. I mean, this is it's a highly desirable place, particularly for a lot of people in Asia and in Europe. They don't ask any questions. It's very, very difficult to get them to recognize foreign judgments, to recognize subpoenas. In some cases, it's a crime for them to disclose any information about any of the accounts that have been opened on those islands, which are literally in the middle of nowhere.
Well, a similar thing happened with Swiss banks, but then a few years ago, the Swiss bank UBS was forced, under a lot of pressure, to release the names of American customers who've been hiding money there for years. Can the U.S. government crack down on tax evaders that way, or was Switzerland a unique situation?
Well, they're trying to do this, and the banks, they have a little bit more power and sway over to convince them, because it's a, you know, it's an organized, nationally recognized institution. UBS, Credit Suisse, there's a lot of banks now that are, if they want to do business in the United States and they want to keep their banking interests alive in this country, there has to be some reciprocation in terms of information. When Americans open accounts in Switzerland, now Swiss banks are notifying the IRS of the identities of those Americans. But it's like going to Ocean City or Coney Island, and you play one of those whack-a-mole games, and you hit one of those little moles that pop up, and then that goes down, and then another one pops up someplace else. And so this is the problem. Every time they clamp down on one place, then another place becomes the hot tax haven. That's starting to happen in South America right now. Uruguay, for instance, is becoming the hot new place for investors to go. And, you know, they can start clamping down on that one, and some other place will pop up.
Now, in the UBS cases, customers who had been evading taxes could participate in an amnesty program, which had some financial penalties. Isn't tax evasion a criminal offense?
It carries very substantial penalties. And so I think the IRS felt that this was the best case scenario for them. There were so many people who that they believe had been moving money offshore strictly for tax avoidance purposes and not reporting it to the IRS. If you are allowed, if you're an American citizen, you're allowed to move your money offshore, but you have to let the IRS know how much money you've moved offshore, and you have to claim it along with everything else on your taxes every year. If you don't do that, it's a federal crime. And so the IRS said, look, you know, we know that a lot of people are doing this. They're not filing the proper paperwork. They're not declaring on their taxes. And if you're one of these people and you let us know, we will not pursue criminal action against you. And so a lot of people came forward, but I think there are probably a lot of people who did not, and they're just keeping their fingers crossed that that they will stay secret.
Well, if I rob a bank, can I just say, put me in an amnesty program?
That's a really good point. And there's been a lot of criticism about this. A lot of people feel that that a lot of American citizens have been given a free pass, that they've been committing crimes for maybe several years or many, many, many years, and that they should pay a penalty.
Half a million offshore companies exist in the British Virgin Islands alone, but only 24,000 people live there. Do the citizens of offshore tax havens see much benefit from the huge amounts of global capital that's being stashed in their countries?
You know, probably a little bit, but I don't think, you know, it's all that much. It's not like some other investment in some company that's going to be hiring lots of people or building roads or bridges or manufacturing anything. This is just manufacturing profits for very wealthy people.
There are 2.5 million documents. How much time is it going to take the Washington Post and others to go through them all?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned at the top of the show, Leonard, there is a number of partners across the globe that have been working with this material. The material has lots of strengths. It also has some weaknesses. The strengths are that it does contain names of individuals and corporations who have opened these accounts, but there's very little information about how much money is in these accounts. So it's really difficult to follow the money because that money is in bank accounts, and that bank account information and transfer information was not contained in the leak of this data for some reason, and I don't know why, and I'm not sure where the leak exactly came from.
Do we have any sense of who leaked it or
we don't,
why?
No. Nope, we have no idea. I mean, I'm sure somebody does, but at the Washington Post, we do not know who leaked the information or why they leaked it.
Although I'm assuming that if somebody goes through the trouble of opening an offshore account, there's some real money involved.
Yes, absolutely. You know, like we said earlier, I mean, we're not going to be opening up an offshore account if you just want to put a few thousand dollars over there. You know, usually it involves hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And a lot of the accounts that we've seen where people have actually reported this to the IRS, that some of that information has been contained in the leaked documents, those IRS forms, and they have disclosed, you know, millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars that are in these accounts.
I've been speaking with the Washington Post's Scott Higham, who wrote along with Michael Hudson and Marina Walker-Guevara a report called Offshore Havens Concealed Dangers. We have a link to that article and other investigations done by ICIJ partners on our show page at WNYC.org. Scott, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Leonard. I really appreciate it.